On this week's 51%, we hear from an author about firstborn daughters.
We usually are kind of thoughtful people. We're not usually the life and soul of the party.
And there's legislation introduced concerning human trafficking. Plus, we hear about perhaps alternative views of Mother Teresa. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Oh, sister, when I come to lie in your arms, you should not treat me like a stranger. I bother when I lie the way that you act, and you must realize the day.
Many of the world's most high-profile women are firstborn daughters. Hillary Clinton, Angela Merkel, Oprah Winfrey, Arianna Huffington, and Taylor Swift are just a few examples. The study of birth order has fascinated psychologists, sociologists, and behaviorists the world over for decades. In her new book, The Eldest Daughter Effect, Netherlands-based author and researcher Lisette Schutemaker explores the similarities she has discovered specifically among firstborn women around the world. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall spoke with Schutemaker recently about her research.
Obviously, you got the idea from being an eldest daughter, but what else beyond that sort of sparked your looking into a book like this?
I've always been really puzzled by, on the one hand, how the same I am, like my siblings, but also how different we are. And especially the brother who came 2 years after me, he's like so different. The more I turned into a good girl, the more disobedient and, you know, rebellious he became. And then I started to observe that many of my friends, I hadn't picked them like that. I didn't know, but they turned out to be eldest daughters. So I thought there must be something in us that we recognize mutually that attracts us, a certain approach to life. And the direct reason was I was having a chat with my publisher. It's like the kind of chat you have before you begin a meeting. And he told me a story about his family. And he said about his eldest daughter and her behavior when he got home and the behavior of the other kids. And I was like astounded. It was like, you're talking about me. This could be a story of my life. And then so we looked at each other and we said, well, maybe there's a book in this.
The eldest daughter, does that mean that they're the oldest sibling in the family or that they're just the oldest daughter?
Well, we are specifically talking about the firstborn, the women that have an elder brother who kind of looked at us often and said, but we're also kind of eldest daughters because he doesn't do it. And they would kind of look us in the eye and say, you know what I mean. And we did know what they meant. So later in life, I think eldest daughters, and we call them functional eldest daughters, kind of take on a lot of the same kind of roles. But the difference is that as a first child, you have to discover, you step into the unknown time and again. You have the nerves of your parents when you go to play school first, or to school, or to university, or whatever. A second born, a woman with an older brother, she has already had that example, and he's already kind of been breaking the ground for her.
Now, when it comes to eldest sons versus eldest daughters, there are pretty obvious differences in society, but the characteristics that eldest daughters have, what makes them different from the characteristics of just a firstborn son?
And I haven't studied eldest sons as much as I have eldest daughters, but one recent study was, for instance, that eldest daughters are really driven and ambitious, and they want to perform, and they are fond of going to school and to learn things. And that is much less the case for eldest sons.
So can you tell me some of the other characteristics of that eldest daughters share?
We discovered kind of five main characteristics, and some of them are a bit similar but still a bit different. So it's like responsible, very dutiful. If an eldest daughter promises she'll do something, she will do it and more, and she will do it before the time. It was great organizing our research event with only eldest daughters because we all, you know, had our emails ready a week before and our programs, and we all did more than, you know, was required for the next meeting.
That's a pretty great study right there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was like a box in a box there. Also, we usually are kind of thoughtful people. We're not usually the life and soul of the party. many youngest children develop a sense of humor. So for them to attract the attention when everybody is older and their voices are louder and their stories are maybe more interesting, then the youngest one becomes the clown. That's not the way of the eldest daughter. The eldest daughter, you know, after what we call the dethronement, you're an only child. You know, all the planets revolve around you. And then one day, suddenly, you have to come off that throne. And so most eldest daughters become like these serious, thoughtful little girls, kind of trying to figure out how to carve, how to stay in this family, how to play a role, how to kind of come off that throne and still be loved and liked and find a place. Because we're given lots of responsibilities at a young age, so you watch your brother while I go into the shop quickly. So we are often people with kind of an overview, and we're very practical. We see what needs to be done, and we do it. We're kind of hands-on people. Also, because of this, having to step into unknown situations so often in our young lives, we're not afraid for the new. We don't know what is ahead of us anyway. So we're really practical and hands-on and willing to organize, and we just get on with it. And the last one is really this caring side, this sense that you need to care for all and sundry. And that is not only your responsibility, but there's this real sense of wanting to.
Now, you can make the argument based on all these characteristics that some very successful women, famous women in this world, are all elder daughters. There's a remarkable number of them. Is that what you found?
Yes. And of course, when I look through the lens of eldest daughters and I see Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Oprah Winfrey and J.K. Rowling, and, you know, I see these eldest daughters and I discard, of course, a little bit the other ones. You can say that the most powerful women in the world right now, which would be like Angela Merkel and Christine Lagarde, and we used to have this Dutch woman in the European Commission, and then Hillary, if she makes it, then they are all eldest daughters. But not Theresa May, actually, who is now the Prime Minister of Britain. She's an only child.
That's a whole different set of psychological principles. What specifically are the advantages of being an eldest daughter?
Well, you come out of your youth being quite a competent and capable person. Society really rewards people who do what's asked of them and are responsible and have this hands-on attitude. So you come out of your youth as quite an accomplished person, actually.
Now, this might be getting a little more granular than probably is necessary, but I'm just curious. Do the attributes of an eldest daughter, are they amplified at all the more younger siblings you have? Or, say, does it matter whether you have, like, one little brother or two little sisters or, you know, three or more siblings? Is that a factor?
Well, I think you put your finger on something. To research this is really difficult because how many siblings, how much younger, what gender, it becomes really hard. The person who, Fai-Fai Bu, who is a researcher at Essex University, who found out this about, you know, the ambition and also the higher intelligence of eldest daughter, says she cannot point to whether one sibling or more siblings makes you go more in this direction. We haven't been able to find data for that.
Say you meet a little girl who has just become an eldest daughter for the first time. What would your advice to a young girl becoming an eldest daughter be?
My heart always breaks a little bit when I meet young girls. And, you know, I would say you're still the first experience and nothing is stolen from you when there is a second one. Really nothing. You may have to share attention. You may have to share time. You have to share all the things that you took for granted for a long time. But you will always remain a loved person. You are still loved. There is no less love for you.
And you've got a pretty bright future in store for yourself, too.
And you've got a pretty bright future. That's good to point out as well, but depends a bit how old they are.
Just looking inward at your experience with this, what did you learn from all of this research and from the writing of the book?
Well, one thing I learned is why my brother is so different from me. And that's because there is a whole Darwinistic look at this that says children actually want all of the attention of their parents all the time. So they will compete, and they will all carve out a niche. And so when I did the typical eldest daughter thing and cultivated kind of my good girl side, the more I cultivated that, the more rebellious and disobedient he became. So we kind of polarized. And it's been such a revelation for me to see that.
Has it improved your relationship with him at all, understanding him better?
Completely. Completely. After all these years. Yes, absolutely. And another thing is that I have this thought, this like inner thought, when, for instance, I came on the board of an organization, and my inner thoughts go like, okay, now they've got me, but they realize they don't really want me, but they don't know how to get rid of me. I think that's typical. That's a real typical eldest daughter thought. It's like, you see, there's flowers in the house. I live in Holland. We have flowers in the house always. So there's flowers in the house. After a week, you know, the flowers are kind of waiting, and a new bunch comes in, and the old are being thrown out. Or there's the old couch that's being thrown out when the new couch comes in, and now there's a new baby. Will they throw me out?
Uh-huh.
Because I must have been a disappointment. You know, a two-year-old, and it's not conscious, it's not in language so much, but that's kind of, so I've deducted that my strong, you know, I really had to hold out in these boards against these horrible self-defeating thoughts. Like you said, talk to that little girl and go like, no, you're fine, you're loved.
That was Lisette Shoemaker speaking to 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall about the findings of her new book, The Eldest Daughter Effect. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was in Rochester, New York recently and announced legislation to provide human trafficking victims with post-conviction relief. In a news conference at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the senator from New York stood with advocacy groups and survivors of trafficking. The bill would clear the victims' records of all nonviolent crimes they committed as a minor while being trafficked. Gillibrand, a Democrat, says those who were forced into acts by their captors should not be branded as criminals themselves.
For a lot of these young men and women, they desperately need it because it's affecting their ability to get loans, to get a college education, to get housing, employment, anything that they need, it becomes an impediment.
Human trafficking is described as a modern-day form of slavery affecting millions of people in the United States and abroad. It can involve the use of force, fraud, or coercion to exploit a person for labor or commercial sex. An independent Egyptian daily says the state's top women's advocacy group has filed a complaint with the chief prosecutor against a lawmaker who called for mandatory virginity tests for women seeking university admission. Maya Morsi, head of the National Council for Women, is quoted by that daily as saying she will demand the lawmaker's expulsion from parliament and a criminal investigation into his actions. She says the lawmaker is harming the reputation of Egypt and its women. The lawmaker said in an interview that virginity tests were needed to combat the proliferation of informal marriages between students. Virtually expense-free, such marriages have become more popular in recent years because of high unemployment among youth and a shortage of affordable housing. Homeschooling is becoming more common, and studies suggest that military parents are more likely to homeschool their kids. Reporter Patricia Murphy looked into the reasons why.
It's the middle of the school day for the Owen children, but you won't find them in a classroom.
Ooh, three feathers.
Six of the seven Owen kids are at Sunnyside Beach in Washington State with their mom, Becky.
Hey, Zoe, you can make a dream catcher.
While 4-year-old Zoe and 6-year-old Joshua look for feathers, 15-year-old Hannah was dreading her next task.
I'm not going to make dream catchers. I got to do like boring stuff like memorize parts of the Constitution.
The Owens are being homeschooled, and this beach trip is part of today's curriculum. They're a military family. Becky Owens' husband joined the Army in 2005, and she says it made sense to homeschool her children because the family moved around so much.
Our first duty station was Germany. But even before we got there, you know, he had basic training, and then he had the other training, and so we just kept homeschooling through all of this because it gave us the flexibility we needed. Other, my kids would have had to be in and out of schools 3 times before Germany.
A decade after their stint in Germany, the 6 school-age children are still learning at home in DuPont, Washington, near where their dad is stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. 18-year-old Deborah says it's been a great experience for her.
Instead of being caught up with all the tests and all the grades and all the stuff that stresses out all of my peers, I've been able to focus on what I really care about and want to pursue.
The Owens are among what seems to be a growing trend. Homeschooling is becoming more popular among the population as a whole. And while the Department of Defense doesn't track the number of homeschoolers, a study conducted for the Army suggested military families are more likely to homeschool than civilian families are. Tom Halverson of the University of Washington College of Education says the nomadic life of military families is one of the biggest reasons they homeschool. Military kids move an average of 9 times before age 17.
That could be a very challenging and chaotic situation for kids, completely jumping into new situations, new classrooms, new students, new teachers, new surroundings. And so a homeschooling situation where students could have that consistency, I think, could be a real advantage.
Like homeschoolers in general, some military parents also want to give their children a religious education or pursue their own curriculum. But Halverson says homeschooling isn't right for everyone.
Especially for older kids, I think that's where you would start to run into a real challenge for parents, is trying to be able to devote enough time to be able to stay ahead of the kids and really provide a balanced instruction for them through some of those tougher subjects.
That's a lesson that Jen Stahl learned when she was homeschooled in the 1990s as her family traveled the world with her Navy dad. She now lives with her husband and 2 kids in Germany and belongs to a group that advocates for tougher homeschooling oversight. When we talked with her on Skype, she recalled the strong military influence of her homeschool education.
It was boot camp, basically, at home. I actually would joke with people and say, you know, the only reason I didn't enlist is because I've already done boot camp.
Even Becky Owen, an enthusiastic homeschooler, ended up putting one of her daughters in a school run by the U.S. Department of Defense in Germany. It happened when her 6-year-old was having trouble reading.
It wasn't clicking for her. She was very stubborn. She thought only dad could teach her how to read, and then dad was being deployed. And so we had her tested, and it turns out that she had visual tracking issues. And she would go every day for reading lessons, a reading class.
Like the rest of the Owen children, though, Hannah eventually went back to full-time homeschooling. And Becky Owen says although every one of her children is different, the family figured out what learning style works for each of them. The Department of Defense says it neither encourages nor discourages homeschooling among military families, and it has no data to compare the academic achievement of military homeschooled children to other kids. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
Texas doctors have done the first womb transplants using live donors in the United States. 4 women who had been born without a uterus received one in recent operations at Baylor University Medical Center at Dallas. 3 of the wombs have had to be removed because of poor blood flow. But a hospital statement says the 4th recipient still has hers and is showing no signs of rejection. There have been at least 16 uterus transplants worldwide, including one in Cleveland that had to be removed because of complications. 2 doctors from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, which has done the most of these operations, were in Dallas to assist with the 4 transplants there. At least 5 births have resulted from the womb transplants in Sweden. Pope Francis canonized Mother Teresa in early September, and Sandy Broy for KALW reflects upon that Sunday and how people view her. Mother Teresa is known for her work helping the poor in India.
Chi può immaginare? Che cosa vuole il Signore?
As I sat down to lunch in Kolkata on Sunday, far away in Vatican City, the woman who made Kolkata famous around the world was becoming a saint. Many would say she's just being officially canonized. She was always a saint. But over the past week, as international media descended on this city, I've come to understand that there is a difference between the saintly Mother Teresa and Saint Teresa. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
I'm not bothered if Mother Teresa becomes a Catholic saint, because if you look at the history of Catholic saints, it's full of dubious people and criminals and fascists. So I have no problems her being a Catholic saint, but I do have problems when people call her a saint in the secular or a broad sense.
That's Orup Chatterjee, one of the most vociferous critics around of Mother Teresa and her work. He testified against her beatification, and he's written a book picking apart her record.
For instance, when she was alive, needles had to be reused by her law. She made the rule. Gloves had to be reused. There was women had to have their hair shaved as soon as they came in.
True to her dogma, she fiercely opposed contraception in a country struggling with population control and opposed abortion, even in the case of rape. Gautam Lewis, who was raised in her home for children, says we often misunderstand her.
I think there is a misconception that she was a social worker. I don't think she was. She had a deep, deep love for humanity. And through humanity, that connected her to God.
Lewis had polio as a child. Left by his own mother in Mother Teresa's care, he went through years of painful corrective surgery. Now he lives in London, where he's managed rock bands, learned to fly airplanes, made a film about Mother Teresa and a music video with Kolkata musicians.
They are from that camp where the memory of Mother Teresa is fading, and it's not that important.
Even if the memory of Mother Teresa is fading, critics say it still leaves scars on Calcutta.
I don't want Calcutta to be seen as a place that exists on Western charity, which is what the world thinks. And it is ironic that upper-class Calcuttans and Indians collude with this worldview.
Sunita Kumar, a longtime friend of Mother Teresa, says it's not about Calcutta.
She said poverty is even in the West. I mean, don't think that just because they have extra pounds or euros or whatever that they are not poor. But they are poor because they don't get any love or care.
Many critics complain that Mother Teresa could have done a lot more with the money she raised. She could have built a hospital, provided far better medical care. Kumar says we keep forgetting these are nuns.
I mean, the vows that they took were just to live simply and serve the poor, and do whatever they could for them. And her idea wasn't to diversify and build hospitals or anything.
Her Nobel Prize made Mother Teresa world famous, but in a way it secularized her as well. It made the world judge her by the standards of social service, not her faith. Suchi, visiting Kolkata from Canada, says Mother Teresa's version of faith, her humble, bare-bones room, reassures him.
I've seen a lot of Christians in North America that it's all about money, yeah, right? They're just trying to raise big palaces, yeah, right?
But it still leaves those of us who live in Kolkata with the disquieting thought. As school children, we donated money for Mother Teresa's poor box every week. But in the eyes of the world, did our city become a giant poor box? Chatterjee.
And as you pump her Mother Teresa, you pump down Calcutta. You have to remember that the two are inversely proportional.
I hope not. I hope Calcutta is bigger than Mother Teresa and that there is more to this city than the nuns' service. Mother Teresa is Calcuttan, but she does not define Calcutta for me. Now that the Catholic Church has reclaimed its most loyal nun with great ceremony, I hope Kolkata can claim its own identity back as well. But that's easier said than done. The government has just announced they are planning a Mother Teresa tourism circuit in the state, expecting a rush of foreign pilgrims. Saint Teresa might just be getting reincarnated in Kolkata as a different kind of patron saint. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1421.